I would like to proceed and try very hard to conclude our discussion of the Bible today, and on Friday to begin a discussion of Socrates and the Platonic dialogues which you have. At the end of the hour on Monday, we were discussing the biblical conception of man. This is essentially, as I said to you at the end of the hour, what the whole thing is about. Almost everything we've said relates to the question of the nature of man, who he is, what he is, actually and potentially. And if in the Bible the approach seems to be, if man were separated from his neighbor, the other man, it would be very difficult to bridge the gap between the two. This is, of course, a fundamental problem in psychology, in society, in philosophy, in religion. As once you put a man in a separate category from other men, then how do you connect the two? Not externally, as in trade relations, say, between the Russians and Americans. We're not talking about external relations, but internally, in terms of an intimate tie and identification. However, if I am the neighbor, if I am the fellow man, the whole picture changes. Everything seems then possible. Everything falls in line. It is no longer difficult, certainly not impossible, to have a relationship with the other. There are obstacles that need to be removed, but the possibility is built into me as a person who is a neighbor. So if I am commanded to love my neighbor as myself, then it becomes possible only if I love myself as the man who is the neighbor to the neighbor whom I am to love as myself. It may sound complex, but it really is much simpler than it sounds. Often words get into the way of ideas. I think the idea, if you look at it carefully, is there. The difficulty is in expressing it in a way in which the separation doesn't appear more sharply than you want it to appear. You're trying to say something in which the separation is reduced to the minimum. But our words don't always allow that to happen. Now, if I may, let me discuss the last aspect of this problem that I want to talk about, and that is about the biblical conception of love itself, which we have said very little about. We've talked about the nature of man and about the neighbor, but what is the meaning of the word love as the term is used in the Bible? There are different words for love, and a large part of the confusion from which we suffer is due to the failure to keep the different meanings separate one from the other. The Hebrew word used in the Hebrew scriptures for love is ahava, which I've tried to transliterate. In the Greek, the word is agape. The Latin is caritas. And then there's another Greek word which needs to be differentiated, and that's eros. The only one I dare say familiar to you is the last. It's the more conventionally one which is the most current. Now, eros is distinguished from the other forms of love. Eros means sexual love. Oh, whatever the love may be, the sexual ingredient is there. And that is erotic love. It doesn't always have to be prominent. It doesn't always have to be featured and be central. But if the basic element is the sexual relationship, the sexual attraction, then it is eros, and we get the word erotic and a lot of other derivatives from that. Now, the biblical meaning of love isn't that. Of course, there is erotic love in the Bible, and it's unavoidable, beginning with Adam and Eve, and it isn't denied. But that isn't what the Bible necessarily is about when it talks about loving one's neighbor. The biblical conception is quite apart from eros. Agape is love in a twofold sense. It's love of God for man, which is quite different from the kind of love that one found in other religions, where usually it is the love that goes out of man, and it may go towards God. But in the Bible, very often the meaning is God's love for man. And the second meaning is brotherly love. This is the much more common sense, certainly for our context, this would be true. Brotherly love without any sexual suggestion. The word caritas was in Latin used as the equivalent of agape and ahava, but in the translation into English, in the King James Version and later on in the centuries that followed, this may not have been certainly was not the intention of the translators of the King James Version. The word became charity. You could see the relationship between caritas and charity, how the Latin could become the English word. Charity took on altogether different connotations. The connotation particularly of almsgiving, of philanthropy, not in the literal sense of love of man, but for helping with a donation, passing the hat, the charity box. Would you please put the newspaper away? The concept became, of course, a perversion of what was intended by the Bible. Now, first of all, in this context, to clear up something which serves as a stumbling block in a reading of the Bible, it goes back to what we have said time and again. The Bible doesn't deal with abstractions. And the meaning of the term love comes through in specific examples. specific actions that are represented as love actions. This is quite in the way in which the Bible approaches problems generally. We talked, for example, a good deal about time in the Bible. There is no concept of abstract time in the Bible. This has been noted time and again repeatedly by scholars. It is always filled time that you get in the Bible. There's a time of harvest, a time of sowing, of planting. There's a time of rest. There's the day of the Lord, the day of the vengeance of our Lord. There's the year of tithing, the year of Jubilee. There's always a filled time, a concrete time, a time of darkness, a time of light. The abstract concept came from another culture altogether. It was not native to the Hebraic mind. So too with the concept of life. There's always a filled life, a person filled with life. This was life. And so too with respect to love. It was always concretized, identified with acts of justice, acts of righteousness. These were acts of love. And the intention was that the specific example would stand for the generalization. But the generalization was never made expressly. It was always left to be inferred. There are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of examples that one could cite, but let me cite a number of examples that are familiar, but you don't notice them because of their familiarity. In Exodus, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter or your manservant or your maidservant or your cattle or the stranger who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Now, the commandment with respect to the Sabbath day is not only, as I've just read it to you, for a person himself to rest, but everybody about him, his maidservant, his manservant, even his animals, they must rest. It's a typical example of the concretization of the element of justice, or the element of righteousness, or the element of love, call it what you will. It's not enough that I should enjoy the fact that God made the seventh day. Incidentally, there's an example of the other situation that we've talked about. The seventh day is conceived of as a different day from the first day, from the second day, just as the second day is conceived of as different from the first day. It isn't just day in general that God has made, but he made specific days. He made 7 days, and one is different from the other. So the seventh day is the seventh day, and it's not to be confused with any other day. It's a concrete time. It's a filled time, a special time. So it is. And with respect to the love relationship, there's no generalization here. But if the seventh day is good enough for me to rest on, it must be good for the next man just as well, including the stranger, including even the animal. Or take as an example Leviticus. This is a clearer example, I suppose, in that it illustrates more clearly the approach which I want to discuss in just a few minutes. Leviticus chapter 19. When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap your field to its very border, neither shall you gather the gleanings after your harvest. And you shall not strip your vineyard bare, neither shall you gather the fallen grapes of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and for the stranger. I am the Lord your God. As the poor and the stranger have a definite relationship to the land. The land doesn't produce only for me. I have title to it in a manner of speaking. There is a harvest. I didn't produce the harvest. I am the Lord your God. That is, I am responsible for the fact that there is a harvest. If I didn't send the rain in time, or if I sent too much rain or not enough rain, if I sent too much wind, whatever might have happened, it could have been in such a way that there would have been no harvest. And so I say to you that when you reap your harvest, you shall not reap your field to its borders. And you shall not gather the gleanings after your harvest. That is, what drops is not doesn't belong to you. You shall not strip your vineyard bare, as you can go through your vineyard once, and what isn't, what doesn't come off, doesn't belong to you. And you mustn't pick up the grapes that have fallen in your vineyard. All of these elements from the harvest belong to the poor and to the stranger. That I'm called upon to love the poor and the stranger. But how am I going to do that? Well, there are different approaches. But one basic approach is through the recognition of the fact that the harvest isn't only for me, but that it is for the others whom I am commanded to love and respect, and they have their rights. Or take Deuteronomy chapter 15. If there is among you a poor man, one of your brethren, in any of your towns within your land, which the Lord your God gives you, you shall not harden your heart or shut your hand against your poor brother, but you shall open your hand to him and lend him sufficient for his need, whatever it may be. Take heed lest there be a base thought in your heart, and you say, the seventh year, the year of release is near, and your eye be hostile to your poor brother, and you give him nothing, and he cry to the Lord against you, and it be sin in you. You shall give him freely, and your heart shall not be grudging when you give to him. Because for this the Lord your God will bless you in all your work and all that you undertake. For the poor will never cease out of the land. Therefore I command you, you shall open wide your hand to your brother, to the needy and to the poor in the land. Now very often when the brother is mentioned, or the neighbor is mentioned, particularly when the brother is mentioned, it is the needy and the poor who are spelled out as meaning your brother. As it isn't left to your imagination to decide on who your brother is. You have no choice in the matter. The needy and the poor, they are your brothers. Now the seventh year is a day of release. After 6 years of the seventh year, people owe money. It's a burden that they can't carry forever. You have to release them from their debts. It's one of the earliest manifestations or expressions of what we call a bankruptcy law, and one of the most humane elements in any economic order. Because life can become unbearable after a while when you realize that you've got so many debts that if you live to be as old as Methuselah, you will never be able to pay them off. You've got to get a fresh start. You have a family to support. You have your own life to live. You've been unfortunate. And so there is this bankruptcy which wipes out the debts. So a poor man comes, and it's getting close to the year, to the seventh year, and you say to yourself, well, he hasn't got very much time to pay me back. Comes the year of release, and you see here's another example of the filled year. It's a separate year. It's a year of release for everybody. It isn't that there's a separate release year for each individual, but there's a common year of release. God made that year. It's filled this way. It has a special content. It's the year of release. So that year comes. It's around the corner. And you say to yourself, well, he's a bad investment, bad risk. I'm not going to lend him any money. So there is this commandment that you haven't any choice in the matter. If the needy man comes to you, you must lend him and not have these base thoughts about what might happen. Think of what might happen to you. Oh, who are you and how does your wealth come to you? Another example in Deuteronomy 24, when you reap your harvest in your field and have forgotten the sheaf in the field, you shall not go back for it. It shall be for the sojourner, for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, that the Lord your God may bless you in all your work, all the work of your hands. And then more specifically, when you beat your olive trees, you shall not go over the boughs again. You can go over them once. What you forget or what doesn't come off the first time doesn't belong to you. It belongs to the alien, the fatherless, and the widow. And so too, when you gather the grapes of your vineyard, you shall not glean it afterward. It shall be for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore, I command you to do this. As if it hadn't been for me, you would still be slaves in Egypt. And so, what have you lost by it? The fact that you are free. And so, when the time comes when you go through your field, don't go through feeling that it all belongs to you. There's the beautiful story of Ruth, in which some of these laws, commandments, or expressions of the love relationship are manifested. In chapter 2 of Ruth, now Naomi had a kinsman of her husband, a man of wealth, of the family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth, the Moabitess, she was not, as you know, a woman born in the Israel, among the people of Israel. But she was a stranger from Moab, but had married into the family. Naomi was her mother-in-law. And Ruth from Moab said to Naomi, let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor. And Naomi said to her, go, my daughter. So she set forth and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz. And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem, and he said to the reapers, the Lord be with you. And they answered, the Lord bless you. And Boaz said to his servant who was in charge of the reapers, whose maiden is this? And the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered, it is the Moabite maiden who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. She said, pray let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers. So she came, and she has continued from early morning until now without resting even for a moment. It's a typical, lovely picture of the law in operation. Now, the basic thought is that people who have suffered misfortune, and in the Bible, almost always typified by the poor man and the stranger. As if you try to think of who could best typify misfortune, it's the man who suffers from poverty, and the stranger who often also suffers from poverty. And the approach here is that these people must be given rights if they are to have any human dignity. And so the law itself is supposed to be an expression of the love relationship by vesting rights in the people who have suffered from misfortune. Because the idea is, and we know that from our own day very, very well, that without legal rights, men are dependent, and they become dependent upon the subjective will of other people who have a monopoly on power. Dependence breeds envy, discontent, resentment, and even hate. It's almost unavoidable that that should be the case. Because we know from the refined psychology which we have today that dependence breeds insecurity. Insecurity leads to self-hatred. One doesn't like oneself when he sees oneself. And so the feelings of insecurity and of self-hatred take hold of one. And then they become objectified, and one puts them on the other person, who, by contrast, is the person of power over oneself. As my insecurity is measured by the other, by my dependence upon the other person, upon his will that I'm dependent upon. And so you hate the other person, you resent the other person. And this is true of nations as well as of individuals. We know this from the way our foreign aid program has operated. People who receive in a state of dependence what you give them suffer from the feelings of insecurity and self-hatred, and then part of that hatred gets to be imposed upon the giver, the powerful nation that's over there from whom we have to receive wheat and grain and rice and other things that come to us from their table. These are the crumbs, as they would be interpreted, from the affluent tables of the American people. Now, to contrast that, rights mean a sharing of power. Because if I have a right, I have that much power. And social justice addresses itself, of course, to the distribution of power. This is what social justice is about. The power to make a decision through my vote or through my representative for whom I voted, or economic power, a decision with respect to my life, or having an adequate income, having some property. I have a stance from which I can address myself as well as my neighbor. Without rights, there can be no justice. There can be only compassion, mercy, as an infant in relation to a parent. And this, unfortunately, is what charity, in quotation marks, the mistranslation and corruption of caritas, became, starting perhaps, I don't know when it started, but certainly from the time of the Elizabethan period, with the Elizabethan poor laws on up, charity took on this meaning. And of course, the King James Version made an unfortunate contribution to the perpetuation of this concept. The strongest possible implication of dependence and continued insecurity. You give a man a little charity, or so he may be able to manage for the day. You give him a little charity for the next day, he'll manage through that day. But he has no rights. and therefore he has no power. And therefore he's not a man, not really. So in the Bible we have a number of conceptions here that come together. Love means, one, that we have duties towards our fellow men, and especially, most especially, towards the unfortunate people, the poor, the men in need, people in need, the widows, the orphans, the sick, the lame, the halt, all that can be put into the category of the people who have suffered misfortune. And these duties vest rights. That is, what is a duty in me becomes a right in him. Now it is their right to go over. So they have vested rights. These are examples, typified. They're not, as I said, put in an abstract form the way we would today in a law. This was not the biblical approach. But the meaning comes through very clearly. And so the vested rights, property rights, economic rights, personal rights, which they may lawfully claim. And so from this point of view, as you see, we can be, and the Bible does, command us to love our enemies. Again, it doesn't mean subjective love, because that would be a contradiction. You might, as a matter of fact, hate your enemy. You're not supposed to hate him, but you can't control always your emotion. But no matter whether you love him or you hate him, the man who is your neighbor, he is your neighbor. And in that relationship, he has his rights. I have my duties toward him. Without regard to the subjective feelings. The text means act justly toward your enemy. If you do so, then maybe you won't hate him. As a matter of fact, that's probably psychologically true. If you deal with him as a fellow man, you might have your differences, which may not be easy to resolve, but you probably won't hate him. In Leviticus chapter 19, you shall not hate your brother in your heart. And again, your brother means your neighbor. And your neighbor means your fellow man. But you shall reason with your neighbor, lest you bear sin because of him. If you reason with him, you probably will not hate him. So the legal foundation must be in brotherly or neighborly love, in the biblical sense of love, which is not, as I said, sentimental or subjective, though there's no objection to having sentimental love, but that's not what we're talking about. So that love and the law can become tied together. There's a tie-in between feeling and action. As a matter of fact, when you stop and think of it, for example, a Medicare, a law relating to medical expenses, there's no concern about who the man is, whether he's lived a right life or a wrong life, and whether I like him or dislike him, he's in need. He needs medical attention. The costs have become prohibitive. Medical costs, hospital costs, they're unbearable. And so we put our feelings, as it were, into a law. And it is an expression of biblical love. If one needs to cite an example from our own day of a law which is expressive of that, I would say that Medicare would certainly, Medicaid, these certainly would be prime instances of this kind of a relationship. Now, secondly, we must act for ourselves only in such a way that our nature as fellow men is made clear. That is, I must act as a neighbor, because that is my nature. And so this is the self that is active outwardly in my social relations. And finally, third, we must act in such a way that we make it clear that all others are our fellow men. I am a fellow man, and all others, including even domestic animals, are my fellow creatures, fellow men or fellow creatures. Now, I think that the record would show, as it has been interpreted by many scholars, that these thoughts, these ideas, these concepts have had incalculable, but insufficient, of course, significance for the development of our society. I would like to read to you the paean to love, or agape, that's the word that is used by St. Paul in 1 Corinthians in chapter 13. The King James Version used charity, where I will be reading the word love. The Revised Standard Version has dropped the word charity, which it should have, because of all the bad connotations that have crept into it, and has substituted love, which is the translation of the Greek word agape in the text. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to move mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. If I give away all I have, and if I deliver my body to be burned, but have not love, I gain nothing. Love is patient and kind. Love is not jealous or boastful. It is not arrogant or rude. Love does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongs, but rejoices in the right. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. It's a very beautiful passage. And I think it does reflect the basic spirit of the Bible with respect to the heart of what said the Bible. Now, if I may conclude this discussion with one more observation. The basic rationale for all this, and it is a concept which today has been rediscovered by theologians and by secular people everywhere. The basic rationale is that God is the creator and is the continuing proprietor of all that he has created. All creation belongs to the creator. In Leviticus chapter 25, for the land is mine, for you are strangers and sojourners with me. As don't get any false notions about you being the owner of the earth. It is mine, and you are only strangers here. In Deuteronomy chapter 10, behold, to the Lord your God belong heaven and the heaven of heavens, the earth, with all that is in it. In chapter 8 of Deuteronomy, you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth. From this premise follows the idea, which is a prominent feature of biblical thought the idea of trusteeship or stewardship of property and of life. Man has only limited rights in relation to anything that God has created, to property and to other men. His rights are always limited and defined. Now, this order calls for the emotion of gratitude, which is inseparable from the man who is really religious. There are many wonderful expressions of this feeling. There's one in the book of Chronicles, the first book of Chronicles, which you probably haven't read, and I don't know when you will ever read it on your own. So let me share this with you. You'll get the drift of it. Therefore David, this is King David, blessed the Lord in the presence of all the assembly. And David said, it's a very beautiful passage here. It's sheer poetry if you listen carefully. And some of this language you'll find, of course, is in the Lord's Prayer. It's very familiar. But this is the context. Please listen. Blessed art thou, O Lord, the God of Israel, our Father, forever and ever. Thine, O Lord, is the greatness and the power and the glory and the victory and the majesty. For all that is in the heavens and in the earth is thine. Thine is the kingdom, O Lord. And thou art exalted as head above all. Both riches and honor come from thee, and thou rulest over all. In thy hand are power and might. And in thy hand it is to make great and to give strength to all. And now we thank thee, O our God, and praise thy glorious name. But who am I, and what is my people, that we should be able thus to offer willingly? For all things come from thee, and of thy own have we given thee. That's a beautiful phrase. That's whatever you give, you give what belongs to God. Even when you give to God something, you give what he has given you. For all things come from thee, and of thy own have we given thee. For we are strangers before thee, and mere sojourners, as all our fathers were. Our days on the earth are like a shadow, and there is no abiding. O Lord our God, all this abundance that we have provided for building thee a house for thy holy name comes from thy hand and is all thine. I know, my God, that thou triest the heart and hast pleasure in uprightness. In the uprightness of my heart I have freely offered all these things. And now I have seen thy people who are present here offering freely and joyously to thee. There are two compensating concepts in the Bible in this context. There is the concept of man having dominion. In Genesis, you'll remember in the first chapter, all things are put under man. Man has dominion over the animals, over the earth, and the fruit. At the same time, there is the concept of stewardship, trusteeship. You need the concept, of course, you need the concept of dominion. Because if man did not have dominion, he would be like the other animals. The wilderness would never become farmland. Animals would never become domesticated. He would be subject to all the forces of nature like the animals out in the forest. So man has dominion, and he builds himself houses and cities, and he builds civilizations and cultures. So it is impossible, of course, to be man, to become man. Man becomes man in the process of exercising dominion. But of course he can push dominion so far as to make the world, as we know, uninhabitable. And so there is the countervailing force of stewardship. He must remember that the earth is not his. He is here only for a short period of time. He mustn't deal with it as if he is a demonic force that can destroy. He can't build what he destroys. He can destroy so fast and so much that there won't be time for the next generation to plant itself as human beings. So you need both concepts, and they do play each a prominent role in the Bible, and of course they have played tremendous roles in our civilization, and in our own day we have at long last begun to see, and there's a great body of literature today on this, how the two concepts must be harnessed together, as we've had such a largess of nature that we've exercised in particularly in this country, but we're not the only ones. Europe and Asia and Africa, everybody has the ecological problem today, which is what it is. It is the overextension of the concept of dominion. And we haven't sufficiently remembered the idea that we are trustees for one another and trustees for the future. Well, I dare say you have questions. If you will write them out, I will try to answer them, and I will proceed on Friday with a discussion of Socrates.